Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a woman who has been in jail for 2 decades for a drug crime and has been denied clemency again and again finally gets what she's been asking for.
But first, President Obama will finish up 2014 with his annual end-of-the-year press conference later today. There's a lot to cover. His most recent announcements on normalizing relations with Cuba, his immigration reforms, the protests in Ferguson, Missouri, the hacking attack against Sony Pictures. Today, the hacker sent a message to Sony saying pulling the film The Interview was a smart move, and the FBI is now formally linking that hacking to North Korea. Rick Klein is political director for ABC News on the line with us from Washington. So, Rick, start with Sony. What is the president, what will he say today?
There is no playbook for this. The big question is, does he label it an act of terrorism or an act of war in some way? Because that could then prompt a new set of questions. How do you respond to something like this? The White House saying that they're looking for a proportional response. I don't know what that means. I don't think anyone does. And the president has to define that. Certainly, we wouldn't go in and hack them and shut down one of their movies and do something that similar. So how exactly we respond to this? It is a new age. And in this sense, if this is cyber warfare, we appear to have lost a battle. And the president's going to have to respond to that in a pretty forceful way, and in a way that's going to write a new rule book.
Well, as you know, Newt Gingrich has already said just what you said, that this is cyber warfare and we have lost the first battle. California Republican Congressman Ed Royce, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, is calling the attack an act of aggression against the U.S. The president will be asked quite a bit about this.
No question. And again, given the context of who we're talking about here, it is North Korea. It is a nuclear power. You have to be careful in how you respond. Is it the kind of thing, because this is an attack on corporate interests, not more broadly? Clearly, it's criminal. But how do you define that kind of warfare and how do you respond? You'd think not respond using traditional military means. We are in a new age. The president and I think the White House getting a wake up call on the corporate front this week.
Yeah. OK, well, what else do you think is going to loom large? There's so much to choose from.
Well, Cuba is sort of the mirror image of North Korea. We have these two isolated regimes and have been long isolated with no relationship with the United States. The president's bold move on that, whatever you think of it, it is vastly changing the relationship between the United States and one of its closest geographic countries. And given the complicated history, more than 5 decades, the president's entire life has been under this a different set of relationships, and most Americans in the same way. The fact that that's changing and we essentially haven't gotten anything in return for that, I think, is going to be an object and a subject of some questioning. What does he need to see out of the Cubans next? How does he intend to move forward? We know there's been a fierce blowback in Congress, but the White House very happy with this development. They feel like that gives them an opportunity to close out the year with some action.
Well, he's been getting pushback from Cuban Americans like Ted Cruz, who have also been pushing back against sort of a parallel issue, the president's executive action to defer deportation for some 4 million immigrants. What are the questions there, do you think?
Well, that is going to be item one when Congress reconvenes in January. And the question of how the president intends to hold back that tide and begin the machinations of effectively legalizing millions of folks who are here, came to the country illegally against the law. How does that begin to go into effect at the same time Congress takes over and starts some defunding efforts? Keep in mind, they funded the entire government, Congress did, through September, except for the Department of Homeland Security. That they had expired at the end of February. Specifically so they could force them to revisit this issue and use some leverage against the president.
Oh, and by the way, while there's a press conference today, the White House is also releasing a draft plan to rate the performance quality of 5,000 colleges and universities, as a lot of families are, you know, trying to get through the application process. Tell us a little bit about what we're expected here on that.
Far different than the U.S. news rankings that have become so comfortable and popular. This is going to involve a whole range of different factors. The quality of education, a piece of it, also the affordability, the price tag, the kind of student loan debt that people graduate with. It is a new system. I think it is an untested system. It'll be a controversial system because anytime you rank colleges and universities, but it's a critical piece of the president's education reform project. It's one area they've been working sort of more quietly in the shadows on in a lot of ways. But I do think it's going to redefine the way that we think about the college education in this country, what is available to everyone, what should be available to everyone.
Yeah. There's just so much more when you think about it, you know, quite a year that we're drawing to a close on in a couple of weeks. But I want to ask you, what do you think the president will be asked or how will he address race relations? Such a large part of the last year.
And he's given a series of interviews talking about it on a personal level. He's happy in one sense that he's seeing athletes speak up in that way. He and his wife gave an interview just a couple days ago to People magazine talking about the way that they've been perceived, their race has been perceived. Look, the president makes a point that things have gotten better. And I think that's undeniable when you look at the course of his lifetime, to cite one example. But when you see the kind of eruptions that we've seen recently in New York and in Missouri and elsewhere, it's clear we have a long way to go. And the president always balancing. It's been a tight balance, a tough balancing act for him throughout his presidency when you think about his position as the first African-American president, but also, of course, as the president of the United States. He, though, feels it personally. Yeah. And as a parent and as someone that's seen people struggle with this, I think he is going to take the question on personally.
Well, but it's a tightrope that both he and Eric Holder walk. And we're learning today that Missouri is saying it's going to sue several suburbs that the state feels have been profiling minorities while they're driving to ticket them to raise revenue. This is something that, you know, we've been hearing quite a bit about. So we have issues like that. But the president, you know, he walks a tightrope on how he addresses them, because he's also sort of still the commander in chief and the person who is supposed to support the people whose job it is to carry out laws.
And the way that he uses the bully pulpit on this will be fascinating, because we have a short attention span society, right? People are not thinking about these issues in the headlines every day until something else happens. How much does he elevate it? How much does he keep it part of the conversation? Because if he continues to talk about race relations, it will force the rest of the country to address it. If he moves on, then the country is likely to move on, and the task forces that he's put forward likely to go nowhere. He's got the potential, through his attorney general as well, who also is African American, he's got the potential to change the conversation if he sticks to it.
Yeah, so much else will be brought up today. The Senate's torture report, ISIS. We will be listening in right here. Rick Klein, political director for ABC News. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, it may have been lost in the mix of all the news coming out of the White House, but earlier this week, President Obama granted what they call Christmas clemency to 20 prisoners convicted of various crimes between 1964 and 1997. That includes 8 federal inmates serving long sentences for drug offenses. One of those is Barbara Scrivener, who served 20 years, just about, on a 30-year sentence for conspiracy to manufacture methamphetamine. Earlier this year, she spoke with me from a federal prison in Dublin, California, and I started by asking her what the judge said when he first sentenced her on drug charges.
Well, he told me that they gave me a 2-point reduction for minimal participation, which was basically knowledge, and I knew what was going on because I didn't cooperate with the government. But he said because his hands were tied and he had to follow what the guidelines were, he was going to give me the low end, which was 30 years.
For conspiracy to manufacture meth, 30 years.
Yes, exactly.
Now, a year after you went into prison, you appealed your case and you were denied, and then you tried to commit suicide.
I did. I didn't think it was going to be very easy for me to live life in prison for 30 years, and I didn't want to do it.
And you tried for clemency again during the Bush administration. What happened then?
Well, when we filed it then, because I had written my judge when I had the suicide attempt, and he said, you know, he's really sorry about that. He wishes that there was something that he could do to help me, but again, he couldn't. But when I filed for clemency, he wrote a letter on my behalf. The United States Attorney for the state of Oregon wrote a letter on my behalf. So we believed that I would most likely get it because we were told the recommendations of your judge and the United States Attorney, the pardon attorney's office follows. So we're thinking if the people that put me in prison are saying I shouldn't have the sentence, then I should be granted clemency.
But you didn't get it.
I didn't get it. They denied it.
And what did they say why they denied it?
They said they don't have to say. They just said it's denied.
And you tried again in 2009. When President Obama took office, did that work out any better?
It did not, but I thought, okay, I listened to Obama's speeches, and he was talking about prison reform and helping, you know, reduce the population, and I knew that I was just a low-level drug offender with a horrendous sentence. I had even more support. My judge still wrote a letter. At, like, 3 of the successive United States attorneys in Oregon wrote letters on my behalf just reading my petition saying, yes, I got too much time. A couple politicians wrote letters, the ACLU sponsored my petition, and I really thought again they're going to give it to me. There's no way they would say no. They want to get people out. You know, this is just, my sentence is just too huge. I really, really believed in my heart that it was going to happen. And again, it did not. And I got very discouraged and defeated and thought, what's the use? I cannot do this again anymore. And then I did try to commit suicide again.
And now you're trying again to get clemency. So why do you think it's going to be different this time?
Well, I had already had in my heart set that I wasn't going to worry about clemency anymore. If my attorney wanted to file it, that would be fine. I just knew at this point in time I have 4 years left, and that's where I was trying to focus on. I couldn't focus on the possibility of maybe, maybe, maybe. But when 8 people just got granted clemencies in January, I was like, oh, they are doing some. And then James Cole made the statement that they're looking for people that are clemency-worthy, low-level drug offenders, so they can reduce the population. And my heart got, you know, a little overwhelmed, thinking maybe now, maybe this is really it.
And when you say James Cole, by the way, you're talking about a deputy attorney general.
Exactly.
Well, do you have hope that you can get out before your sentence is up?
I want to say yes. But it's hard, so I kind of want to say no, because I just can't afford to get heartbroken again. I can't afford to go there. I believe this that's going on now seems really positive, and just maybe, I do just maybe think this could finally be it, and I can finally go home to my family.
That's Barbara Scrivener. She's an inmate in federal prison in Dublin, California. She has served 20 years of her 30-year drug sentence and is waiting to hear about whether she will be granted clemency. Barbara, thanks so much and best of luck.
Thank you very much.
And again, the news this week, Barbara Scrivener was one of 20 prisoners granted clemency by President Obama. Her sentence will now expire on June 12th. Until then, she'll be assigned to a halfway house, perhaps by the end of this month.
Cubans are hoping that closer relations with the U.S. will mean more jobs and the chance to get a hold of luxuries that are taken for granted elsewhere, things like meat, cooking oil, even toilet paper. While they look forward, though, to those comforts, some are worried that their culture will change. 3 years ago, our next guest traveled to Cuba to photograph that culture. It was his first time there, but it's a place he's heard about his whole life. Artist Andres Serrano's mother is Afro-Cuban. He is well known for one work in particular and a warning. Even saying its name is offensive to some people. It's the 1987 work Piss Christ, a photo of a crucifix and a pool of urine. It caused a firestorm, especially when it was discovered that Andres received federal funds from the National Endowment for the Arts. We wondered, how would he be received in Cuba, a communist but also Catholic country? Photographer and artist Andres Serrano joins us from New York. Andres, welcome.
Thank you.
And your thoughts when you heard the announcement this week?
Okay, I've waited 6 years for the president to say and do what he's done. I think it means a lot.
Well, tell us more about your relationship with Cuba. Your mother was born here, but then we understand raised in Cuba, spoke only Spanish?
Exactly. When she came to New York in the late 40s, I think in 1948, she spoke no English. And she remained Cuban in the sense that she never learned English for the rest of her life. And so at a very early age, I had to not only learn Spanish, but I also was aware of Cuba, particularly since, you know, I was 9 years old when the Cuban Revolution took place. So Cuba was uppermost on my mind always.
But in what context? Because, as you mentioned, there was a revolution. A large swath of people fled. So how did your family view Cuba?
My family came before Castro. And so on a good day, my mother would praise Castro. On a bad day, she would criticize him. However, even though I had never been to Cuba, because of the fact that I have some Cuban blood in me, I was stigmatized, particularly in the fifth grade when a student learned that my mother was Cuban. He started to call me Castro and Cuban. I was stigmatized by that because, you know, it's the late 50s going on 60. I'm 10 years old. And to be called Cuban in America was a real bad thing. And I was horrified to be linked with that. So I was very much stigmatized by being Cuban.
That's so fascinating. It's hard to get across to people how petrified Americans were of this threat just a stone's throw off Florida. And you, as a child who had Cuban blood in you felt that you were identified with that terror.
But I knew I wanted to go to Cuba, but I wanted to go for a reason. And about 2.5 years ago, I asked to be invited to the Havana Biennale. And in doing so, I was invited to not only go and show some work, I was invited to go there and do some work.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that, because here you are, the artist, infamous for one of the most controversial pieces, as we said, and one that many Catholics in particular were insulted by. Here you have a Catholic country, Cuba. How did they receive you?
They received me with open arms. In fact, someone once said, called me a Cuban artist, even though I wasn't born in Cuba. And certainly when I went there to do my thing, I was allowed to do my thing, and I did it better than anywhere else. I mean, I went to, oftentimes I would go up to strangers' homes and be invited to go in there and take pictures of people I didn't even know. As an artist, I was embraced very well.
You spoke to Raul Castro's daughter and Fidel Castro's son, Alex.
I not only spoke to them, I took pictures of them. And, things are not always what they seem. For instance, we think of Cuba as being so repressed and people's freedoms taken away. Raul's daughter, Mariela Castro, is the head of an organization that champions the rights of gay, lesbian, and transgender people. Mm. They're a lot more, humane than we give them credit for.
But you know that there are human rights issues. You were photographing people. What were you trying to capture?
I was trying to capture a picture of Cuba that was different from the pictures of Cuba, the books on Cuba that I've seen, meaning, the cars, the romantic 1950s cars, the colonial houses and the beautiful light. I was trying to get to the people of Cuba. It's a very different experience than me going as a tourist, an American tourist, yeah, and thinking, oh, the people are so happy and they're always singing and dancing on the streets. And, even though I saw some singing in clubs, I didn't see people particularly dancing on the streets. And, if you didn't have any credit cards, if you had no money, if you had no iPhone and very little access to the internet and no way of making a living, I don't think you'd be doing much singing in the streets yourself. And, I photographed all kinds of people. I photographed people who are considered middle-class Cubans. I photographed people who are considered lower-class Cubans. I photographed people who live in houses with dirt floors.
Well, some of the adults you photographed were partly or entirely nude.
Well, again, it may be a conservative country, but it's a country, and I'm not sure it is a conservative country. As I said, I was able to do everything I would do here or anywhere else, I photographed people in the nude, which I consider nude portraits. I would think you would say, wow, this is Cuba. This is what you found in Cuba. It's a very diverse picture of Cuba.
I asked you about how you were received in this very Catholic country. You said with open arms. In the past, you've also had to explain you are a Christian.
Well, here's what I want to say about, not about Piss Christ so much, but about Cuba and the fact that when I learned that Pope Francis had a hand in what happened in Cuba, I understood that to be everything I expected from the Pope, because not only is he a great humanitarian, he is also a man who shares a lot as an Argentinian with the Cuban people. They share a cultural identity that's different from Europeans. And I've been denounced by fundamentalist right-wing groups in America. I would love to appeal to the Pope to recognize me as a Christian artist who believes in Christ, in God, and who would love to work with the church as an artist.
And could you just explain that for the people who can't understand that? You've told us this before, that even though you made that controversial piece of art, you see yourself very much as a Christian. How do they square?
As a Christian and as a Catholic, a young Catholic, I was raised to believe in the body and blood of Christ, his bodily fluids. There's the recognition of Christ not only as the Son of God, but also as a human being.
Andre, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure, thank you.
Artist Andre Serrano. And we have this update now to a story we've been following. FIFA, the group that governs soccer, has agreed to release a legally appropriate version of a controversial corruption report on the highly criticized bidding process of the 2018 and 2022 World Cup tournaments, which were awarded the tournament to Russia and Qatar. That report was written by Michael Garcia, who found rampant corruption in the sport and resigned on Wednesday after FIFA refused to make his scathing 430-page report public. FIFA said it was against the organization's ethics code and made a shorter version of the documents public, but those were said to be inaccurate. FIFA's president, Sepp Blatter, said he asked the executive board to release more documents now, saying, "We have always been determined the truth should be known." A terrible story is unfolding at the Masterpiece Equestrian Center in Davie, Florida, where the fourth horse to eat tainted feed died this week. The feed was laced with the antibiotic Menensin, which is safe for cattle but toxic to horses. And in fact, another 18 horses at the horse farm are going to die when their organs ultimately fail. Lakeland Animal Nutrition, which provided the feed, says it was only sent to this one ranch and the company has recalled the product. The horses' owners are considering suing. But meanwhile, young riders at the ranch have stepped up to take care of the horses in their last days. Joining us is 13-year-old Jamie Buis. Her family owns two horses, Ultimatum and Dontavia. And Jamie, this is so terrible. We're so sorry. What did you all think when you heard this?
We didn't really know about the poison. I mean, no one's ever heard of that. That's not a common thing to happen. So we weren't sure what it meant for the horses.
Yeah. Well, we understand the first horse died in October. People thought it was colic, but then when more began to die, this poison was found in the feed. First of all, I mean, people probably have questions. What was explained to you about why there's no cure?
Well, we can't work them because it basically attacks their heart and all their organs. Yeah. So if we do ride them and their heart starts pumping harder, then it will go into their heart worse. So basically it's just attacking their insides.
Yeah, what we understand from poison is that it breaks down the system. I know with my dog, they tried to give vitamin K shots to try to make the blood clot, but if the poison overtakes it, it just doesn't work and you just have to wait it out. So when did you decide to just give them this, you know, almost like a spa in their last days? What are you doing?
A couple times a week, we have the younger girls come in and groom and bathe and give treats and just take care of all the horses.
And so what are you doing? Are you going every day or what are you doing?
Yeah, I've been going every day to see my horses. We give them a lot of baths and rinse them off if they're hot, and we brush them a lot, and we give them lots of treats and give them hay and just make them as comfortable as possible and happy.
Tell us about your horses.
They're both show horses, and they both jump and are amazing horses. When you own a horse, you have a connection with them that you can't really explain to people who don't have horses.
Yeah.
And it's really incredible when you get on that the relationship that you have on the ground with them, it translates over into riding. And the horses are more willing to work for you when they love you and like your company.
So how are you doing this?
It's really difficult. I've never had a harder time before in my whole entire life and been through so much sadness at one time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been 3 months, and it's every day it gets sadder and sadder. They were basically losing all of them, not just one horse that we like.
That's unbelievable. But, you know, Jamie, why are you doing this? Some people might ask, if you know the inevitable, why not put the horse down?
Because, I mean, they're a family, but it's not an easy... It sounds easy to just make the decision to put them down, and I'm sure a lot of people think that it's mean to keep them alive, but how do I get myself to put my horse down when from the outside he looks okay? So until I know that he's not comfortable or that he's in pain, he will stay alive until I feel that it's the right decision to put him down.
Yeah. Well, yeah, has this changed you?
Oh, definitely. I didn't realize how much I appreciate my horse. I've never been through something harder. I didn't think I would have been able to, like, if you told me a couple months ago that this would have happened, I would have laughed and said, oh, I can't handle that. I realize how much stronger I am now.
Well, Jamie Buis, I'm sure you've impressed a lot of people there. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. And thank you for giving this the attention that it needs.
With less than a week to go before Christmas, stores are trying to lure shoppers in with last-minute deals. The holiday shopping season can account for as much as 40% of a retailer's annual sales, according to the National Retail Federation. But what if that weren't the case? What if we spread that money around throughout the rest of the year? In other words, dare I say it, is Christmas actually bad for the economy? Derek Thompson is senior editor of The Atlantic. He's looked at the research and he's with us from New York to talk about it. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be back.
And is Christmas bad for the economy?
On the one hand, asking whether the holiday season is good for the economy is it's sort of like asking whether Thanksgiving is good for turkey sales or whether Valentine's Day is good for chocolate and flower shops. It seems like an obvious answer. Of course, the holiday season is good for these sales. Some retail companies expect that as much as 40% of their annual sales are going to come around this season. But what I've asked in this piece is whether this is really the best way to arrange annual shopping, to have all these families wait and wait and wait to buy what we want, and then suddenly to flood these stores all at once, meaning longer lines, messing up these stores, meaning that these stores all of a sudden have to hire all sorts of short-term, part-time employed people to staff the stores, and then buy gifts for people who often don't like what they receive. Is this, in fact, the best way to organize shopping and giving? And what economists, who are the Scrooges of the academic world, have said is that no, in fact, this is not the best way to arrange our economy.
Well, the thing that comes to mind is also if you put all of your eggs in one basket, if you will, if you hope that December is a great month for sales and then there's terrible weather, that could really screw you up as a retailer for the rest of the year and make your overall sales figures be down. But what did economists find when they looked at this?
So there was this Wall Street Journal forecasting survey from a few years ago, and it found that 2/3 of economists thought that if Christmas didn't exist, it's not as if we would simply go about our lives the exact same and then not buy all this stuff. We would simply spread out our shopping throughout the year. And by spreading out our gift giving more evenly, we would first avoid the potential of a terrible Christmas season, in which case the weather prevented us from shopping. But we would also potentially shop more efficiently so that stores wouldn't have to stock up on part-time workers all at once, then suddenly let them all go when it becomes January. That we would shop more evenly, buy what we wanted for ourselves and for other people when we wanted it, and that sort of smoothing of consumption would be better for everybody, both the shoppers and the stores, who could more better plan for when people were coming in.
But isn't there that value in both for the giver and the receiver that it feels good to buy something for somebody. It feels good to get something for somebody. There's thought put into it. Even if it's, you know, an ugly sweater, maybe, you know, your mom enjoyed getting you that ugly sweater and it makes you think of her when you wear it.
Well, so this is the conversation that I always have at the dinner table around this time of year when I'm talking about the dead weight loss of Christmas, which is such a terrible phrase. The idea is that if grandma buys me a sweater for $100 and I would happily exchange it for something that's only $70, there's loss there. There's $30 that I just don't care about. And it would be much more efficient if she just gave me five $20 bills instead and we could buy something that we both valued at $100.
But what's the fun in that?
But there is no fun in that. That's exactly the point. Life is more than economics and numbers. Gifts feel good to give, and gifts feel good to get. And there are neurological benefits of what academics call pro-social spending, and the rest of us just call the joy of buying stuff for people. We enjoy buying presents that, even if they aren't efficient, carry a message, a signal that says, I know you, and I cared enough not just to go to my ATM and get you $20 bills, but to go to a store and browse it and see a reflection of our relationship in a shirt or a sweater on the rack. That's just a part of the joy of family and friendship. And so I think that even as there are clear economic arguments for cash being the most efficient gift, it is not the most efficient way of telling somebody that you love them. And for that reason, I remain a defender of gifts in the abstract.
Okay. And then let me throw this in as well, because some economists have said that people who don't like their gifts and then end up trying to resell their gifts online, that actually is good for the economy as well.
Well, it's funny because on the one hand, it's inefficient to buy somebody something that they don't like. But if that means that we have to return it and go back to the store and continue shopping for ourselves, what you are doing is potentially generating more economic activity. You're forcing there to be lots of multiple sales for one gift. First, the sweater, then my realization that I don't like it, then my going to Gap and realizing that I actually want to buy all sorts of other stuff because now I'm back there looking at the sales rack. So there is a possibility that the economic inefficiencies introduced by Christmas actually are good for the economy, particularly when what it needs is a little bit of a jolt. And so that is another sort of silver lining to the deadweight loss that is the holiday season.
Now, you've looked at some of the research behind what people actually want for gifts, Derek, and economists have found that even despite what we just said about ugly sweaters, giving money is the safest bet. But men and women want very different things from gifts, too. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. There are a couple studies that came to a conclusion that might be familiar to listeners, which is that men tend to enjoy gifts that are a little bit more practical and less sentimental than women. So if you want to buy a gift for a guy to tell him that you love him, maybe some electronic equipment or even a watch. Women, it's said, like jewelry a lot more. Maybe a watch is not so efficient now that we have cell phones on us to tell us the time.
Yeah.
Right. But that women tend to like more sentimental gifts that might not have clear practical value. And that if you want to tell a woman that you love her, maybe the best thing to do isn't to buy something that's utterly practical, like some piece of equipment that you found from Home Depot to help get her apartment or house up to snuff. And so it's just interesting to think about that this goes back to the fact that when you give a gift, it's not just about thinking about that gift economically efficiently. It's about understanding the person and what they want and how they want to be seen in your eyes. And gift giving in a lot of ways is not just economic, it's relationship building. And So it's important to think about what men and women want.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, a warning. If you have a small tot waiting for Santa, perhaps they should go to another room. Okay, Santas. You start to notice them in late November, in the malls, outside stores. We don't often stop to wonder who the men are under the beards, beneath the red stocking caps, and maybe there's a reason for that. As Sean Hurley from Here and Now contributor New Hampshire Public Radio recently discovered, sometimes Santa has a secret he wants to keep.
Below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, New Hampshire, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
He was this, like, big, burly, strong guy.
For the hotel's night manager, Kristen Burkholder, it was hard to tell whether it was a damaged hip or knee that made the man's limp so pronounced. Burkholder noticed that the man's two front teeth were missing, that part of his right ear was gone.
He said that he travels with a Santa Claus costume, and if we wanted him to, he'd be happy to hang out in the lobby for an hour and read stories to the kids.
There wasn't any time to make an announcement or put up signs, and Burkholder still isn't sure why. She finally agreed to let the strange man sit in her hotel lobby.
I'm kind of thinking, oh my gosh, Santa's about to show up and this may backfire.
The man disappeared. He dressed in crimson robes and tucked his wild hair into his Santa wig and drew the white hair down to cover his damaged ear, and fixed a plate into his mouth so that Santa would have two front teeth.
But he sat down, and all of a sudden, within minutes, there was a line of kids.
Come on over here. Would you like to climb up here?
There you go.
Are you looking forward to Christmas?
Yeah, and I saw Johnny.
You saw Johnny?
The owl.
Oh, where did you run into Johnny?
He went in our wreath.
Oh, he went in your wreath, though. That's a good place for an elf, right?
Yeah.
He was so great. He was such a nice guy, super interactive, very patient, very friendly.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. That once upon a time, he'd been a kind of nightmare to kids all over the world. But by the time the line had cleared, one of the hotel staff had figured out Santa's real identity.
I have to get your autograph because my daughter's a wrestler.
Santa puts a shushing, secret finger to his lips.
Sorry.
She was a wrestler, and she would love...
What's her name?
Carrie.
How do you spell that?
C-A-R-R-I-E. She would love it.
Weighing 287 pounds, Mankind!
He was born Mick Foley on Long Island, New York. His manifestations as Dude Love and Cactus Jack are infamous, but none are more deranged than Mankind.
It was 1996 when Mick Foley belted a Hannibal Lecter mask over his face and stepped into the ring as Mankind, one of the darkest, most unhinged, most controversial, and most successful characters in professional wrestling history. The same year Mankind was born, 1996, Mick Foley visited Santa's Village in Jefferson, New Hampshire, and it soon became his favorite place in the world.
I think I was able to explore that that darker side because I had the yearly visits to this place. I honestly feel like that helped me cope, that I could really be convincing in my bad guy mannerisms because I had a really nice counterbalance in the, you know, in the joy of Christmas.
I was probably 16 or 17 when Mick first came to the park.
Christian Gaynor runs Santa's Village with his sister and brother-in-law.
Every year he's here, unannounced. He shows up. He's part of the family. We welcome him with open arms and his whole family.
As a matter of fact, it was on that roller coaster there that my daughter, who in 1998 would have been four, kissed me on the cheek. And when I asked her what that kiss was for, she said, "Because you're a good man." And slightly more than 24 hours later, I was thrown off a massive steel structure by The Undertaker.
Look out! Oh, Look out, that killed me!
Oh, my God.
God is my witness! He is broken in half!
And so after all these years, one of the great questions I have is, what in the world was I doing at Santa's Village the day before the biggest match of my career?
Not only the biggest match in his career, Hell in a Cell is considered one of the great events in WWE history, but the injuries he sustained during this 16-foot fall from the metal structure, which knocked him unconscious, hastened the end of his formal wrestling career in 2000. In 1999, during an autograph session, Foley got the sense that his days as Mankind were coming to an end, and that another character, maybe his last, was preparing to emerge.
Halfway through this massive line, I saw this little boy with the telltale scars of many, many surgeries for severe burns.
Foley called the boy up to the front of the line.
It was then that his mother told me that Antonio had needed to wear a mask during the process of his healing. At the time, he was three, and like most three-year-olds, wanted nothing to do with the wearing of a mask until his mother told him that his favorite wrestler, Mankind, wore a mask. And it kind of filled me with this sense of joy. And so I asked his mom if he could sit on my lap, and people were visibly moved. And as he walked away, I got this distinct feeling that I knew what it was like to be Santa Claus, and a distinct feeling like that this was something I would like to experience again.
And so he did. After visiting Sierra Leone in 2008, Foley funded construction of a large primary school there, which was completed in 2009. In 2011 alone, as a volunteer for the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, Foley logged more than 550 hours talking to victims. Following Hurricane Sandy, Foley gave his dining room furniture to a Long Island family who'd lost theirs in the storm. He then promptly invited himself over for dinner so he could eat at his old table one last time. In 2012, it became official.
I have an official ambassador's letter so that anytime I put on the red suit, I am officially known as Santa Mick.
Foley was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2013. He knew exactly how he wanted to leave his fans.
I tried to talk Mr. McMahon into allowing me to exit Madison Square Garden on a sleigh flying into the sky. And I knew he had the capability of making it happen. He just didn't understand why it was so important to me.
And so, below a half moon, on a snowbound night, high on a hill in the town of Littleton, an unexpectedly large man with an overturned bucket of tangled hair stepped into the lobby of the Hampton Inn.
And you, young man, what would you like for Christmas?
Maroon catching gear.
Maroon catching gear.
None of the children and none of their parents knew who the man in the red suit was. They called him Santa, and they knew inside him lay all the goodness and all the care and all the mystery and hope. Inside him, the single, simple majesty we believe exists in the very heart of all of mankind. For Here and Now, I'm Sean Hurley.
Of course, he is Santa. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.